Institute.
I have two introductory comments. The first is that the rather harsh and repressive spirit of our time is not shared by the executive of your institute. Those of you who may have been tardy enough not yet to have taken out a membership for this year will find when you do so tonight or next week that you have not only a membership for this year but also for next. That seems to us the spirit of generosity and magnanimity that should be more widely loose in the land. The second announcement is that thanks to the good offices of our president this year, Dick Vogel, donations to the Vancouver Institute are now tax deductible. We need these donations. We hope that you will continue to make them and to enlarge them. And now please do understand that your receipt for a donation to the Vancouver Institute is tax deductible. Our distinguished speaker tonight is Dr. Jeffrey Elton, Regius Professor of Modern History, Fellow of Clare College, University of Cambridge. He will be at the University of British Columbia this next week under the auspices of the Cecil and Ida Green visiting lectureships, for which we thank the Cecil and Ida Green Committee for his presence here tonight. Dr. Elton was born in 1921 in Prague, Czechoslovakia. Born into an academic family, his father was a professor of ancient history. The family fled Czechoslovakia in the late 1930s to escape the Nazis, settled in England, and young Jeffrey was sent, speaking not a word of English, was sent to a boys' school, Rydal, in North Wales. Within a year of coming to that school, he was an assistant master. He was also enrolled as an extension student at the University of London, doing a degree in history. A degree which he achieved with first-class standing in 1943. He then was involved in war work, intelligence work, using his command of European languages to good advantage, and after the war returned to graduate study in history, enrolling at University College, taking the one research fellowship that was available at the college at that time in history, and embarking on a thesis on royal administration under the Tudors, a thesis that was completed in 1949 and published in 1954 under the title "The Tudor Revolution in Government." By this time, he had taught for a year at the University of Glasgow and had been appointed to Cambridge University, there becoming shortly a fellow at Clare College. In short, in a very short span of time, sir, this was a remarkable course of events. To have left one culture, to have left one language, to have adopted another culture and another language, and very quickly to have mastered it to the point of writing a major study on a complex period in British administrative history, and moving right towards the pinnacle of young scholarship in the British Isles, an absolutely extraordinary achievement in just over a decade. He was also by this time a fellow of Clare College. And some of you will know that Clare College must be one of the most lovely places on the surface of this earth. An absolutely magnificent 17th century building, a superb small bridge over the Cam River under a spreading beech tree, the finest public garden in Cambridge. I should think that Clare College would have a certain capacity to take in scholars and as it were, to diffuse them in a way that I think the probably the top floor of the Buchanan Tower can perhaps do. But I should say that this diffusion, if that's what it is, has not happened to Professor Elton. By my count, he has written 11 books. It's rather hard to tell exactly. Some of them are two-volume affairs. There's some edited, but that's approximately it. 11 scholarly books. He has won virtually every award that is open to an historian in our day. He is a fellow of the British Academy. He has been a president of the Royal Historical Society. He has been a president of the Ecclesiastical History Society. He is the president of the Selden Society. In 1983, he was elected a Regius Professor, an appointment by the Queen, Regius Professor of Modern History at Cambridge. There are two such positions in the British Isles, the other at Oxford, and I understand, sir, that the holder of the other position is a close relative of yours. Well, there seems ample evidence that Professor Elton has avoided the blandishments of the seductive blandishments of Clare College, Cambridge. But there may be one way in which that college has influenced his work. For those of you who don't know, I should tell you that the main buildings of Clare College are 17th century, that they are dignified, formal, composed, ordered, geometrical buildings in the rather played down, modest English way that sort of classicism has got into the British Isles. To one side of these buildings is a rumpled ancient wall, a thing of brick, of clunch, I think it's called, which is a rather rotten limestone. The whole thing is higgledy-piggledy and random and disordered. And these two different worlds, the one of order and proportion and balance, and the other of a measure of medieval randomness, meet, do they not, at a corner of Clare College. And there, and at that corner, precisely at that corner, is a bush. And that bush, it seemed to me, although I have no statistical evidence, is probably the most remarkable bush in the British Isles. One half of it is ordered and precise and clipped. And the other half of it grows in a natural, random way, you see, and reclines against its rough wall. Now, sir, for the last 35 years, you've walked along the path of Clare College, and I'm sure you've observed that bush, and have mused about the tension inherent in that bush, the ideological polarization that's represented in that bush, and have reflected on the relationship between that bush and the larger tensions, the larger polarization of the Tudor world that you've been studying. Well, I don't know how far one can take that observation about the environmental relationship between Professor Elton's work at Clare and the larger situation at Clare and the larger corpus of his work. But it is certainly true, ladies and gentlemen, that we have with us tonight one of the distinguished historians of our day. Professor Elton, we are delighted that you are here. We welcome you among us. We look forward keenly to your lecture on the roads to the Civil War in England. Professor Geoffrey Elton.
Dr. Harris, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll forgive me if I confine my very sincere gratitude for your generous invitation to a few words so that I can spend more time on the history, which I think we've come to talk about. But I want you to understand that I am most appreciative and most impressed by your kindness, your generosity, and up to a point by your buildings. What I'd like to talk about tonight is the problems posed by the civil wars of the 17th century, not really so much the problems posed to a historical understanding as the problems posed to historical analysis. I'd like to take this opportunity to show you what can happen when a major topic in history is treated, ill-treated, permanently distorted by entrenched views, prejudices, political notions, how the serious study of history can be harmed by what should have no room in its exercise. And I think the history of the Civil War in its aftermath, the Civil War after the Civil Wars, is an object lesson in what should not happen and must, if we can help it, never happen again. It's obvious, I think, to everybody that what happened in the middle of the 17th century, the breakdown of normal relationships, the fact of war, the truth that Englishmen shot one another in the cause of war, spiked one another upon pikes, burned down one another's houses and castles, and produced a revolution in the structure and powers of government, that this was a crisis of major dimensions. Also, it seems. And it has always, of course, attracted a great deal of interest. And why not? It is a major event. Yet the explanations that have been offered for this event have been marked by a quite extraordinary quantity of historically false assumptions, political prejudice, and bigotry. For a long time, it seemed very obvious that what had happened here was the product of a long series of growing conflicts, rivalries in both ideas and powers and religion, reaching back, as the theory went, with great ease to the origins of the English Reformation in the reign of Henry VIII, when two strains and stresses, so we were told, were set up. On the one hand, here there was a government of great potential as well as great power for the exercise of absolutist and authoritarian views and practices, to be opposed increasingly by men who valued liberty, who stood for the right cause, who opposed the growth of Stuart absolutism, who were men of principle, men of goodness, men who tended to emigrate to the United States. Secondly, we had there men of Puritan views, opposing false, semi-popish doctrines in the Church of England, setting up the truth of Christ against its perverters. And so we had two long streams of opposition growing out of constitutional dispute and out of religious principle. And for a long time, these views held the field. It should have been from the first a very serious warning. Oh, before I go on to that, there was one other view which I think needs stressing. The Marxists intervened, as they will do. And they produced out of the constitutional conflicts a notion of a major class struggle. What happened in the 17th century, we were told for many years from Marx onwards, was the triumph of a bourgeois revolution. Indeed, not to put too fine a point upon it, the whole of Marx's own historical underpinning to his theories was the English bourgeois revolution of the 17th century. He had no other to rely on, unless he cared to nominate Periclean Athens for yet another such example. The fact that there was no bourgeois revolution in the 17th century has been a rather serious problem to Marxist doctrine since then. more particularly in the work that some of you may have encountered of Mr. Christopher Hill, whom I used to respect at one time as a man perverse in his notions but honest in his intent, and I know now to have been perverse in his notions and dishonest in his intent. However, this Marxist deviation is only one form of the constitutional conflict doctrine which ruled the prehistory of the English Civil War for a very long time indeed. Now, it should have been a warning from the first that if you look a little more closely at what had happened, you find that this was the doctrine propagated at the time by the victorious party. The whole interpretation of the events of the mid-17th century to very recent times derives almost directly from the propaganda put out by the side that won the Civil War. This, I think you will agree with me, is not the safest of bases for analyzing a major historical event and its complications. But it triumphed. In 1641, the House of Commons passed a thing called the Grand Remonstrance, which rehearsed, allegedly, the recent events which had led to the great crisis, and stated the causes and stated the complaints, and it became the doctrine of historians for 300 years. The doctrine which Herbert Butterfield dubbed Whig, and which, if I may dare say so in present company, was very largely lawyers' history, a respectable thing for lawyers, but a disaster for historians. I could elaborate this, and if anybody wants to ask me what I mean by that, we will leave that till later. It is not that I have anything against lawyers. They are necessary occasionally and useful sometimes, but but historians should not go to school with them. That's all I'm saying. Now, the second doctrine built into this was that of the Puritan Revolution, the notion of a single-minded, determined body of good Christians who regarded the church, the official church, as corrupt, separated from it, and ultimately won a great victory, which was, of course, temporary. Like all revolutions, all good revolutions, the English Revolution ceased, and everything went back to normal afterwards. The Puritan Revolution, which was the triumph of good Christianity over bad Christianity, and which was very largely the doctrine of another line of propaganda conducted by the dissenting nonconformist churches of the 19th century, more particularly against the growing spirit of Anglo-Catholicism in English society, which seemed to threaten a return to Rome. In other words, the doctrines that we were taught to understand in explaining the events of the mid-17th century were all of them conditioned by the politics, political and religious, of the 19th century, then became entrenched in historical research and historical answers, and became unchristianed. What assisted them very largely, too, was the fact that a great deal of this work, and I wish before I go further to emphasize that I am uttering no prejudice, I am condemning no cause, I am lamenting no nation, very largely the intervention of a very considerable number of historians born, bred, and practicing in the United States of America, who got everything wrong. And they got everything wrong because what they were concerned to prove was not what happened in the 17th century, but that 1776 was justified. The history of the English Revolution of the 17th century was rewritten or developed in order to demonstrate that the American Revolution of the later 18th century was the proper, just, and good outgrowth of the phenomena which we can find in England in the 17th century. The triumph of liberty, the triumph of constitutionalism, the triumph of moderate, sincere Christianity. George Washington, the son of Oliver Cromwell. A matter not very easily visualized in physical terms, but spiritually entrenched. not true. Very little of this is true. We're in real trouble over these events now, and it is this trouble that I want to say a little bit about tonight. Increasingly, in the last 20 years or so, people who have actually investigated what happened began to realize that the traditional story lacked conviction at all points. I have to confess that it is generally thought, for reasons which I don't myself find entirely convincing, that I started it all about 20-odd years ago when I drew attention to the very simple fact that the people who lived decades before that war broke out didn't spend every morning saying, oh, by the way, there's just another 15 years before we have a civil war. What do we do in preparing for it? People were reading everything backwards. There was a civil war, therefore those who had lived up to it knew it was coming. Now, obviously, this is nonsense, but the whole of that historical interpretation assumed this nonsensical framework. No one seemed to realize at that time that the people who lived through the prehistory, the decades, even century and a half of which we're talking, did not know that at the end of it, two armies were going to march about the realm of England fighting one another. Once you grasped that, everything had to be started afresh. I think that was true. And once you grasped that, you had to look at what actually happened instead of following doctrine. Now, this is an enormous gain in terms of historical research, and not all that universally followed in any area of history. Do please remember, when you think about history, when you think about the past, that the people you are speaking of are people as alive or as dead as you yourselves, as entitled to their own rights, as regarded in the terms in which they live, in which they can think, and not pieces in a chess game that the historian or the politician or the social scientist, worst of all, can order to please himself upon a chessboard of his own designing. We're talking about reality. We're talking about life as it can be seen, as it can be understood by those of us who live in our own day, transferred into the past, not that thing which will satisfy this or that political doctrine, this or that analytical achievement, but reality. And this is what makes history so very difficult. So very difficult because it will not order itself to the rules, the concepts of an age that it never saw, but has to be understood in its own right, in its own terms. Now, the minute we started looking at it that way, the first thing that became apparent was that the notion of a constantly and steadily increasing opposition against the crown would not work. There was no sign of it. The second thing that became apparent as we looked upon it in this, if you like, new light, was that what had been spoken of was a construct and not a reality, a construct governed by the notion that the true role of history is to lead by stages from the rule of monarchs to the rule of democracy. You may like to believe this, I can only tell you that there's no historical evidence for this doctrine whatsoever. Democracy has been, democracy has gone. Democracy may come again, democracy may go again. There are no laws in history which make it a triumphant ultimate achievement, derived from the events of the English Civil War, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Nigerian Revolution, or whatever may go on in Vietnam. There are no such laws, there are no such certainties, and those who have tried to turn 17th century English history into a background and an underpinning of such doctrines have done ill towards both the cause of history and the cause of freedom by begging questions that must be answered, not skimped over. Let us go back to the 17th century and look at it a little more closely. In the first place, is it true that there was a war between the king and the parliament? By an unfortunate convention, largely propagated by the time itself, this has become the terminology. which therefore entirely covered up one basic fact, that the Parliament included the King. There could be no war between the Parliament and the King, because the King was part of the Parliament in the doctrine of the day. It was a convenient, a kind of journalistic term to speak of the war between parliamentarians and royalists, but it was not a truth at its fundamental root. What happened was that a governing body, a very difficult mixed governing body, King, Lords and Commons, got into political difficulties, which in the end, for a reason that I hope still before we're finished to say a word about, broke into war. But we're not talking about two elements in the Constitution, the King, the Parliament, designed as mutual controls, intended to prevent excesses on either side, finishing up in a conflict which in the end was irreconcilable. Because we're talking about a single, ultimately decisive, legislative and governing body, the Parliament, the King and Parliament, in which there were political strains. And there always had been, always would be. The Parliament, in fact, the English Parliament, from its beginnings to the present day, has been not a guardian of liberty, but an instrument of government. A convenience. A good way of doing the political work of rulership. It has proved itself from the 13th century onwards as a body which can bring satisfaction to the needs of both the crown and the subject, useful to both, particularly useful to the crown, and to this day, really, a body which the cabinet of the day, replacing the monarch, controls as it pleases most of the time. But it's a political instrument. It needs argument, management, exchange of views. It needs good sense and all the rest to make it work. And in that way, strains and stresses are prevented rather than exacerbated. And that, for 600 years, has been its function, which, on the whole, it has successfully discharged. So the first question we need to answer is, why did it fail to do this in this period we speak of? Secondly, in the 16th, 17th centuries, it's quite manifest that the body that mattered in this, mattered least in this complex governing body, was the House of Commons. We have been led to believe that the lower house of the Parliament is the body that really matters. And there are still people today, resident, I regret to say, largely in the United States, who believe that, who still dominated by 1776, need a prehistory for their own revolution, who believe that the House of Commons is the guardian of liberty. And then there are people who are mostly resident east of the curtain who think that, of course, it's the representative of capitalist ascendancy. Well, both these concepts are nonsense. The House of Commons is a much overrated body, always has been. It is a much overrated body because it consists of members of the Parliament who like to think themselves important. Let me assure you that MPs do not matter at all. They would do much better to occupy some decent manner of earning their living. They would be very good refuse collectors. This is actually what they're trained for. They might do better, I don't know quite as what, as guardians of the public morality in promoting pornography. They might do many things that are more useful than sitting in the House of Commons voting as instructed. But they're not useless. They give the facade of agreement, consent, which is very essential to this form of government, by their activity, and they get very good perks for it. They're innocent people on the whole, harmless, rather like mice. But the thought that they are the great carriers of the historical wave, the truth of human development, is one which even 5 minutes, 5 seconds study of them might extirpate in anybody's mind. They are a convenience, a public convenience in every sense of that dubious word. And the House of Commons has never been a body of great power, These are legends. It's never had any money of its own until very, very recently. If the House of Commons wanted to light up the dark place of an evening, it had to ask the Treasury for money for the candles in question. It's a body of relatively feeble power. This is a thing that very few people seem to realize. And that, indeed, until it now acquires independence and financial power of its own, was a saving to it because it kept it in its place. Who, then, in the 17th century really mattered? The whole history in the past of this particular institution and the way in which it moved into a scene of war and so forth was written from the point of view of the lower house. We have heard a great deal of John Pym. I expect a lot of people here have heard of John Pym. This is not Francis Pym who now attacks the government of the United Kingdom from outside since they threw him out, but it's a descendant of his, and as feeble as the original, as worthy as the man of the past. Nobody knows much about John Pym. He's a man of no significance, really. He had no private property in the terms of a landed society, which valued standing by landed wealth. Pym had none. He was a man of work to the Earl of Bedford. He was a clever man at writing up propaganda, and he was particularly good at pressing the great propaganda line of the day, which was the threat of popery. You just, you know, when things got a bit out of hand, you got up on your feet and said, "The Pope is rampant. Papistry is raising its head." And everybody nodded wisely and said, "Yes, indeed, how wise Mr. Pym is." It was a trick. Pym is a much overrated figure, as indeed are most of the members of the lower house at this point. Who ran the show? Well, at this point, I have to take another side jump briefly and attack yet another interpretation that has been rather dominant in these views. In 1956, I think it was, or was it 65? 65. This is just a sort of dyslexic problem. In 1965, Professor Lawrence Stone, now of Princeton, then of Oxford, produced a book which was called The Crisis of the Aristocracy, in which he demonstrated that in the early 17th century, the nobility of England underwent a major economic crisis, which grew into and reflected a major political crisis, in that it lost ascendancy, standing, and weight. Now, what Stone really proved was the existence of an aristocracy. What he totally failed to prove was the existence of a crisis. This, however, has had a very serious consequence. He contributed to the old tendency to forget the nobility. Anybody who even gives a moment thought to the nature of English society in the 16th and 17th centuries must recognize that the dominant body in the body politic beneath the king was the nobility. The aristocracy are the real power holders. They may not be the men of virtue. They may not be the men of political sense. They may not be the men who write the poetry of the day, although there are many people who would like to find a nobleman to have written Shakespeare instead of that distant, ignorant, and minor product of the central shires, this fellow William. But if you even give a second thought to a society in which wealth was landed wealth, in which landed wealth was overwhelmingly concentrated in the hands of a small, ascendant group of noble families, in which nobility represented standing, you cannot understand how ever they came to forget about the aristocracy in the 17th century, except on the grounds that you had to prove somehow the rise and victory of the middle classes, of the bourgeoisie, of the House of Commons. This major gap in our understanding is being remedied. Of late, we've had some work. It's not yet anywhere near publication. I ought to explain that here I'm speaking about work being done by one of my PhD students on the way in which the aristocracy actually managed the 1640s. It was the nobility from the House of Lords who dominated everything. who plotted the schemes, who organized the attacks on monarchy and the management of affairs, who both led into the war and led out of it, and who by an accident were deprived of the fruits of their ascendancy in 1649 when the House of Lords was abolished. But we've got to remember the nobility. Now, I've so far only tried to set a few of the scenes. Now, let us look at the whole situation and see if we can, at this point, supply anything like a new view of the roads to the Civil War, which no longer depends on the illusions of a long-term growth of opposition in politics and in religion from the Henrican Reformation onwards into the outbreak of the war in 1642. That old notion must be dropped. There's no evidence of the growth of political opposition until at the very earliest in 1628 in the great debates upon the Petition of Right. There's no prehistory to this at all. Disputes, yes, arguments, yes, but you know, if you take every argument to be the beginning of a revolution, you're going to be in a very bad way. There's never going to be any peace anywhere. If people are not allowed to dispute without being called revolutionaries, you might as well pack it all in. You then have nothing before you except revolution or death. And both are death. So that is not the truth. Argument, dispute, disagreement, publicly proclaimed, publicly argued out, these are phenomena of true life, of a live political scene, which needs resolution by, again, dispute and argument and disagreement resolved. It is not the prehistory of revolution, and nothing, I have no time to work this out at length, nothing in the history of the English political scene before about 1630 can begin to support the view of a forthcoming revolution, a revolution over the horizon. Nothing. All it can say is that a lot of people exercised their right to think, their right to argue, their right to profit, and there produced political scenes of the conventional kind, which happen in a given society, in a live society, every day, and do not mean the coming of revolution. As for religion, Puritanism is now one of our great problems in English history, again aggravated by the American aspect, because Puritanism in North America, in the colonies of Massachusetts and so forth, is in fact a different thing of what Puritanism is in England, and too much English Puritanism having been written about by Americans once again. I'm sorry, this isn't actually anti-American prejudice. This is straightforward historical analysis. Has been read in under a guise of what is Puritanism in Massachusetts, but that's not Puritanism in Lincolnshire or Peterborough or Cambridge, that strange place. It may be beautiful, but it's the vilest climate in the kingdom. What we now begin to realize is that Puritanism is, in fact, not a revolutionary movement. It is a movement of people who are members of the Church of England, who are in the thing itself, who do not separate from it. They're not sectarians. They're people who are zealous enough to want to take their religion, a religion that I think no thinking man today could take very seriously, their religion of a deadly predestination, of a ghastly election of the few saved, and the condemnation, that very satisfactory feeling you get for thinking that, but for you, for every one of you, millions are damned. How nice to think that. You're not one of them. This kind of zeal is inside the church and wants to produce better Christians than it may be, but not a revolutionary or splintering movement. We no longer quite know what to make of Puritanism as a term. My own answer is, in the reign of Elizabeth, I can find only one definition of a Puritan. The Puritans are all those whom the Queen doesn't like. This is actually more or less true, but not terribly useful, of course, in defining what Puritanism might be. Running a skew of Queen Elizabeth was possible on a variety of causes, including premarital sex amongst her attendants. But even she didn't call her dishonest maze of honor, Puritans. But she didn't like Puritanism, and that's the only definition I really find works. So we cannot have a Puritan revolution because there was no such Puritan movement, in fact. Nor can we have, as I said, a political movement of revolution. So what happened? We are a long way, actually, from giving a proper answer, but I'll give you what I believe to be a reasonably accurate preview of what will emerge in the next 20 years or so from the current state of research. And the interesting thing about it is that it links not to a distant future, not to 1776, not to the Reform Bill of 1832, not to the Russian Revolution of 1917, not to 85, I think we are now, aren't we? Yes, or somewhere like that. It links to the historical past of the realm of England. If you look at the political events in English history from about Magna Carta, which they often appeal to, constantly appeal to in the 17th century, to the events of the 17th century, a similarity, a line emerges, which is very interesting indeed. Every serious political crisis is a crisis between the monarch and the great men of the realm. Call them barons, call them nobility, call them aristocracy. That system depended for its daily working on a reasonable agreement and cooperation between a monarchy that was actually effective, not fainéant, not non-existent, but actually working, and those of its subjects who had both the power and the will to both exploit it if they wished or to frustrate it if they wished. And the normal situation was one of cooperation. The realm worked, the system worked, the king ruled because he was both king and on good terms with his great men. And every crisis is one created by the great men saying, "My God, this king we cannot work with." It happened in 1215 and Magna Carta. It happened in 1268 and Simon de Montfort and the supposed beginnings of Parliament. It happened in 1327, the deposition of Edward II, and so on and so forth. And it happened again in the 1630s and 40s. This is not a new view. The view that I explained to you was the traditional one that grew out of the Grand Remonstrance and the triumph of a given party which established its reading of that history as the truth of history. Propaganda turned into conviction was matched at the time by other views. And one of the best commentators on the events of 1640 onwards was Edward Hyde, later Earl of Clarendon, who in 1640-42 was in fact on that side of the Parliament that wanted to restrain excessive exercise of power by the Crown and was worried about the way things had been going. He then found that things were going further than he had expected, and he found himself joining the King and ultimately finished up as Lord Chancellor of the Restoration in 1660, and then, like everyone who served the Stuarts, got kicked in some rather vital part of the anatomy and left for exile. Serving the Stuarts was always a mug's game and would still be so today. Ingratitude was their chief characteristic. But that's another point I could elaborate if you wish me. But Clarendon, quite in his account of what happened in the history of the rebellion, said in a passage much overlooked that what had happened was that some great man dissatisfied caused the whole rumpus, and he was right. Now, if we remember that we were really looking for the relationship between the crown and the nobility, and for the activity in the aristocracy in these parliamentary sessions, everything tends to drop into place quite quickly. It is becoming clear, for instance, that the whole story of what happened from the session of the short parliament in early 1640 through to the execution of the king was dominated by noblemen of opinion, of conviction, of power, and especially of clear ideas of what the government of England should be like. The government of England should be royal government in concert with the great men of the realm. And they found that this, with this king, Charles I, they could not work. In the last resort, indeed in the first resort, the great upheavals of the middle of the 17th century, civil war, revolution, the abolition of monarchy, the creation of a republic, turn out to be an almost accidental byproduct of political dissatisfaction on the part of quite a small group of people who held local power throughout the realm and who found this particular monarch unworkable with. Now, not many people will accept this at first sight. Great events must have great shadows. A major upheaval like that of that period that we speak of cannot surely have been without there was profound disagreement in religion, in political view, in ideology, and so forth. And there is some truth in it. I have already said Puritanism as such will not work, but yes, there were strains in the exercise of religion and the rule of the Laudian Church. I have already suggested that real opposition is not to be found, but yes, there were disagreements in views on what the monarchy really was like, what the English Constitution really was like. There were those who put the monarch high, had absolutist views about his power. There were those who put him under the law and wished him to be constrained by it, but all as loyal servants and subjects of the crown. No one more determined to prove the ascendancy of the common law than Sir Edward Coke. No one a more loyal and obliging servant of monarchy than Sir Edward Coke until in 1620 he found himself frustrated in a political ambition. He thought he had the Lord Treasurership in his keeping. He didn't get it. He turned into opposition. I think a very proper point decision to take. And he wasn't on the best of terms with his wife at the time. It was a hard time. And why should he not exercise proper ambition in the service of law of the common law? All of it supported a powerful ascendant crown which had to work in political terms with those men in the realm, more particularly the aristocracy, the upper gentry, whose consent and cooperation alone could make monarchic decision into effective action. That was the reality. It broke down over the existence of this king. The trouble with Charles I was that he was totally untrustworthy, unreliable, a liar, on the best possible grounds. He took the very simple line that he was God's anointed, and his only responsibility was therefore to God. And he was the kind of man who always found his God in agreement with himself. They're not unknown the world over. It's a quite convenient way of looking at things. And it is certainly better in some ways than the man who forever finds himself at odds with his God and in politics does nothing but lament. I don't think I need specify. So Charles I was a man totally confident that his relation with the God who had made him king entitled him to lie to everybody else, to kick over the subsistence and substance of all the people who wished to support him but couldn't in the end find themselves serving a man who just could not be believed, who could not be trusted. And that really was the issue in the whole business. It was the nobility who made that war. It was the nobility who first of all tried to make the parliament in which they would give the king the money he needed to remove the Scots army that had invaded England and in return would get him to appoint to his high officers, to the governor of the realm, those that they could trust. The king reneged on that, so the money wasn't forthcoming. It's a long and detailed story, actually, in the 1640s, which I have neither time nor full equipment here to tell you now. And a lot of work is going forward on it, which is far from being completed. But it's quite apparent that what the Long Parliament was not a revolutionary parliament at all. It was a normal parliament convened for the king's purpose to raise money for his needs, ruined by the king's failure to run those purposes effectively, or, if you like, by the overambition or the over-reluctance on the part of the men of power to sit against him. The people that are coming to the fore now, and it's rather interesting in this, are not John Pym,
not Oliver St. John, not Viscount Falkland, all these members, of Hampden with his famous resistance to Shipman. This is one of the greater legends. It sort of goes more or less with throwing a dollar across the Potomac. These men are of increasingly minor significance. And the people we're going to hear about a lot, people you've never heard of, are men like Lord Say and Seal. William finds Lord Say and Seal a man of good religious convictions, a man of immense wealth, a man of political skill, a man who, whenever things got tricky in those ages, is found retired to the island of Lundy, which he happened to own and which was well out of the way, is turning into one of the great figures of the 17th century. I find this rather nice. He's not a terribly agreeable man, but you know, he was a scholar. He wrote treatises against monarchy, mostly. He was a crafty politician of very high principle. That is to say, he was, like all politicians, of high principle and crafty. He was probably not a terribly nice man, but you can see him actually in action. You can see him doing the things which do lead to the outbreak of the Civil War. He isn't trusting this king. He cannot bear this king. He cannot have, unless this king is put in leading strings, he, Viscount Say and Seal, and others like him, the Earl of Warwick, who controlled the navy, the Earl of Northumberland, who was a very competent politician and worked together with the second Earl of Salisbury, and all their followers pushed into the right places to run the realm, they will not, they cannot any longer cooperate with this monarch. And this is what really happened. And this aristocracy maintained its ascendancy in a rather remarkable fashion right through the events of these upheavals, and even after the abolition of the House of Lords in 49, which happened to be an accident because Oliver Cromwell temporarily wasn't looking. He was just about to be made a peer, actually. But that fell through when Colonel Pride, of his own volition, abolished the House of Peers, temporarily, of course, because most of those peers sat in the rump parliament. We tend to think because the House of Lords was abolished, the aristocracy vanished from the scene. No such thing. They're still there right through the Republic of the 50s. They're safeguarding one another's interests. They're making damn sure that if anybody's going to lose his lands and his money and so forth, it's not going to be the nobility. And they're sitting there ready to come back in 1660. Behind the scenes, of course, but very successfully. All these people are the rulers of England. And they're making sure that if there is a revolution on the face of it, it's not going to go too far and very likely is going to revert. All the explanations that we have traditionally received about all these great issues depended on the notion that major disruption in the body politic is the only thing that can explain what happened in the 1640s and 50s. Surely, a civil war must mean that people are so much at odds that cooperation cannot be. The rift goes right through society. If that is true, then why 1660? How come that when Oliver dies, within 18 months, the whole chimera is gone, forgotten? 15, 16, 17 years of English history vanish overnight. Snow on the hills of tropical islands, gone at one breath. And back we are with a society, with a system of government, with a complex of concepts, ideologies and notions, in which the only new thing is a conviction that you've got to be damn sure it shouldn't go as badly wrong again as it did in 1640. Nothing else is new. The old order, never seriously dented, returns manifestly and, in a sense, magnificently. Although the new king, as they discovered in due course, was as untrustworthy, as dubious, as much as a liar and a crook, even more so than his father had been. Of course, Charles II is forgiven because whereas his father was terribly upright in matters of marriage and paternalism, the son was a sexual deviant and a crook. So that's all right, that makes it fine, you see. In politics, they were both equally disastrous. But everybody's very kind to Charles II because of Nell Gwynne. That's not a very good reason, I can tell you. But in reality, nothing had happened that left a permanent effect except a kind of rift in the mind. Never again. Make sure in time that this never happens again, because it was oversight, inadequacy, incompetence, and not deep cause that had led to the Civil War. People will take a lot of persuading of this, but perhaps they may remember that this was not the first Civil War in English history, though it was, as it happens, effectively the last. You cannot call 1688 to 9 a Civil War. But it was not the first. There had been several wars of that order and several more occasions when only very narrowly genuine civil war was avoided, more or less by accident. Premature death here, bad weather there. From the days of the Norman conquest onwards, the situation at the top of the political pyramid had been very like a cooperation between a powerful, self-conscious, self-confident, law-based monarchy and the instruments through which it ruled the realm, which were the great man. Cooperation made for peace and order and political debate. Lack of cooperation made ultimately for breakdown and the potential, or more commonly the reality, of something very like civil war at the top. In many ways, what happened in the 1640s was the last, and in some ways the most drastic, exemplification of this permanent characteristic of English political life. And they got over it in those 20 years in which they suffered the rule of Oliver Cromwell and so on. But in fact, the old order, under the surface, carried on quite merrily until it could raise its head again above the surroundings in 1660. The past explains the Civil War. The future explains nothing at all. But what really explains the 1640s and 50s is the 1640s and 50s. It is not long prehistory, an easy explanation for any historian who wants to set up a theory. Any historian who wants to set up a theory ought to turn to sociology and resign his citizens' rights. The truth is to be found in the event itself. And the event itself can only be understood if you approach it free of preconceptions, free of notions which propaganda, tradition, if you like, self-interest, political and national self-interests, have so long established that it takes a major dynamite charge, a succession of major dynamite charges, to break it open again, to think again, and to arrive at what will not be the truth, there is no such thing in history, but will be nearer the truth, nearer the reality, much more like what actually happened and what those who went through the experience would understand, than all the theories of the great fight for freedom, the battle for the bourgeois revolution, or the triumph of Puritanism, that a mixture of self-interest, tradition, and idleness have inflicted upon us as an understanding of the 17th century.
Questions?
Sir.
Could you give us an indication of your views of the role of Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell, in this period, and your assessment of his contribution?
Yes. The question is the role and contribution of Oliver Cromwell to the general melee of those days, right? It's a very interesting question because, in fact, as Oliver himself explained, and no one apparently took very seriously, he never knew where he was going. And he was right. His chief contribution was that he was a man of powerful and much underestimated ambition, who knew how to pick his moment. I don't think Oliver had anything like profound theories or thoughts. And why should a politician have those? And this is a sort of academic prejudice. Unless a man is full of theory, he cannot be any good. But in politics, it works the other way on. Unless a man is free of theory, he can be no good. Oliver worked by a peculiar form of prayer. He could not do anything until he had God's agreement, which he achieved by getting on his down on his knees and asking advice. Until that advice came, he seemed to dither, no answer, and so forth. When the advice came, since it came direct from God, of course there was nothing he could do except carry it out drastically, this very minute, and which greatly surprised those who'd seen him dither for weeks ahead, you see. This was a very good recipe for success, taking people by surprise. And what he, in fact, largely achieved was to take hold of what could have very easily developed into a total disruption of the body politic, as a lot of rather mad ideas and the like got the upper hand, and control it within manageable limits. He himself was no revolutionary by nature or by intent. He was a man convinced of the old order, really, who happened to have a very powerful dislike of King Charles and the Arminian religion. I haven't said anything about Arminianism and Lord. A lot more could be said about this, but what really drove Oliver on, like so many of the members of the Long Parliament in the first instance, was hatred of the Earl of Strafford. The man who made that war was the Earl of Essex, the third Earl of Essex, Robert Earl of Essex, later chief commander of the parliamentary forces, a man much admired in his day and buried with royal honours. He wanted Strafford dead. And he made that parliament for that purpose. He promised the king his money, which he then couldn't fulfill, if he gave him Strafford. And I think that is what happened. And Oliver played along with that because he hated Strafford too. Strafford was a very characteristic Yorkshireman. They're very hateable. You might say the Arthur Scargill of the city. After that, however, he wanted order and power. He was a man of great ambition, and he had the military ability, he had the army with him, and he worked together with the noble ascendancy in the upper house, who were trying to bring some sort of order out of the war that had happened, and he beat them too. But of course he died, as old men do, and that was the end of his ambitions. Thank you. Madam. What fables are we living with today? Well, I think we all have our own fables that we know about. They are endless, of course. I think one fable is that this is the biggest fable we live with today is that this is the greatest age of danger to mankind. There has never yet been a generation that did not believe itself to be more threatened than any that had ever been before. And for a reason, good, because the earlier ones, they had survived. This present one, none of us know what's going to happen tomorrow, so of course we're in bigger danger. But that's the current fable that I think is the most striking, yes. Yes. It is, in fact, in many ways, the easiest life that ever has been. Yes, sir. Hmm. Yes. This overestimation of the House of Commons. Well, it's a long, long, detailed story, of course, but the fact is that when you look at what actually happened, two things become clear. One is that in terms of political argument, the guidance is from the upper house. They shape the scene, they set it, they control in the 1640s the joint committees of both houses, everything that happens in those committees, who were really running affairs on behalf of the embattled Parliament of the War, the Lords take the lead. The Commons are agents, quite useful agents sometimes. The Lords cannot themselves, for instance, run all the financial committees. So they put their people in. This is demonstrable in detail. It's not the commons who do these things, the commons serve. In larger terms, the commons never had any real power, as I tried to indicate, in themselves. They depended entirely on the crown. The crown summoned the parliament. Without the crown summons, no parliament, until 1693. When they're summoned, well, they are entitled, of course, to bring their problems and so forth, which are mostly the local problems of the locality of the individual. They're not great carriers of major political issues or major political doctrine. And they have no money. They have no independence. Insofar as they have a place to meet, an hour to meet, privileges and so forth to meet with, these are all granted by the crown. So the commons are kind of, it's a kind of miasma. And I ought not to overstate this. Of course they're of interest. But a history of England, which writes itself around the rise of the House of Commons, as J. Neill did, as Wallace Notestein did, is just totally unrealistic. It just bears no relation to what actually happened in the day-to-day events of either the politics or the parliament. The politics were court politics, not parliamentary politics. And the parliament is not the great guardian and so forth, and the House of Commons needs to fall. I'm sorry, it would take hours to elaborate that. Will it do for the moment?
Question here.
The Levellers and the Congregationalists. Well, now, there are two different things here. I played down Puritanism before. I don't want to deny that when the war broke out, sectarianism became dominant with the abolition of the church's overall control, and we tend to call Puritan the very phenomenon that before the Civil War we would have denied was Puritan. Separatism, sectarianism, is not Puritan until the war. Congregationalism is important in this. It was the kind of the modification of extremism on either side. If the Church of England, abandoning its ancient principle of comprehension, of allowing a variety of observances and so on under its umbrella, was going to go Laudian and extremist in that way. And if on the other hand we had the Presbyterian movement, which the Scots demanded and which nobody in England wanted, the Congregationalist independents, who permitted the use of the prayer book, if the local minister wanted to use it and the congregation wanted to use it and so on, do form a kind of survival of the adiaphora, the via media principle of the church, which comes back in considerable strength in 1660. I think that was their, as it were, world service contribution. As for the Levellers, they've been terribly overestimated. What the Levellers really were brilliant producers of pamphlets. And it is one of, well, it's an important point to realize that historians are very much dominated by their evidence. And therefore, if even two people write an awful lot of pamphlets, as Overton and Lilburn did, well, then they suddenly loom large and important in history. But what they were just very good writers, or very busy writers, and they quite a lot of printers in the London Company of Stationers were radicals. So it was easy to get into print if you were a radical, which I may say is still the case.
Sir.
Your comment on the form of government, such as the Canadian one, which is a Senate without aristocracy.
Yes. What are you going to do with a nation that has no aristocracy? Yes. Well, I'm afraid up to a point we face this problem in England too now, of course. What we've now got is life peers, and nobody in their senses would call that an aristocracy. But I'm very sorry, I have no answer. Time alone will solve this one. You better find yourself an aristocracy. Sir, I think that up there was first, if you'll forgive me.
My knowledge of history, sir, is limited to 20 years ago in a GC course that I've long since forgotten. It is not clear to me why it took the Roundhead 7 years to part Charles from his neck. Why did it take so long to settle him?
Well, you know, there is a certain... why did it take so long to get rid of Charles I? Well, first of all, of course, the Roundheads, as you call them, were not a majority in the nation. A lot of people were still rather convinced that the monarch himself had a claim. Whether they fought for him or not, they were very reluctant. Right through the war, there was a very powerful movement for peace on terms acceptable, which was only defeated because the king forever deceived them. You see, they could not trust him. This was one chief reason. There was also a very profound and well-entrenched view that monarchy is divinely protected, that the king is God's anointed. You've got it in Shakespeare and everything. You do not break loose from that kind of conviction, which is centuries old, without some really heart-wrenching troubles and fears. It was only the execution of the king, which was politically a terrible mistake, but probably inevitable. You had to get rid of the king somehow. If he didn't have the decency to die of the plague or something, which would have been quite easy, well, he had to be decapitated. But it was politically a disastrous mistake. It made a hero of a man whom nobody had liked much before that. But the reason why they didn't do it sooner was, well, there was in fact no anti-monarchical movement. The Civil War was not a war against the king. It was a war, as the Parliament said early on in the stages, whereas the king, advised by evil counsellors, has raised war against his realm. The king started that war in many ways. So they wanted to come to terms on conditions which would preserve the old order. And that, of course, meant leaving the king alive and putting him in leading strings. That was what the nobility wanted, and that is what Charles refused. And that is why it, in the end, came to that crisis of the 30th of January of 1649. I used to like to lecture at Cambridge on that day on the problems of the Stuart monarchy against all the monarchists that you do find nowadays. But I think that is the answer. Why did it take so long? Because it was inconceivable that you would do it, and yet they were driven to it in the end. Question here, yes? I'm sorry, I can't hear. I speak of this. Yes, who will see? What will they see? I ought to warn you that it is my firm conviction that the last thing historians can do is prophesy with any confidence. A prophecy has nothing to do with historical understanding, as Cassandra found to her misfortune. What will historians in 300 years, 300 years is an awful long time, yes, think was the ascendant order today? I don't know. I think they'll say it's the women, myself.
Yes.
Colonel Pride, very little. Very little is known about Colonel Pride, except his rather unfortunate name, really. No, we don't know much about him, so far as I'm aware. But the best work on the actual events of that day is David Underdown's study of what he called it Pride's Purge. It's the politics that lead up to that and the event. So far as I'm aware, there is an account of him in the Dictionary of Radicals, edited by Richard Greaves and Robert Zeller. In volume 3 of that, you'll find a sort of, Dictionary of National Biography kind of entry. But in terms of what was the man really about, did he know what he was about and so on, I know of no study. No.
Yes.
I'm sorry, you'll have to speak up. I can't hear you down here. What can we learn from 16th century England in relation to South Latin America, did you say? Well, I think what we can learn from that is so often in historical parallelism that there is absolutely no relationship. It doesn't help. Quite honestly, I don't wish to sound snide about it. I hope you'll understand that. The trouble is that the notion that you can learn from history is an illusion. There are no two situations alike, and any attempt to make them alike for instruction purposes perverts one in the interest of the other, or uses one correctly and perverts the one that you're trying to use it for. And therefore, as a simple instruction from historical experience, that doesn't work. What does work is that if you understand a historical event reasonably correctly, it first of all warns you against any oversimplification of any situation. It makes you realize that whatever any side in a conflict claims is almost certainly going to be a magnificent lie. And it doesn't matter which side, all of them. The truth is never what people pretend it is. It takes a long analysis thereafter. All I can say is that if you want to understand what goes on in Latin America today, the English Civil War is of minimal advantage. You might get more out of the problem of Corinth in the 5th century BC and revolution in ancient Greece. But honestly, I have no idea how to answer your question usefully. I'm just distrustful of all these attempts to transfer the understanding gained from one situation to a totally different one by some kind of process of instruction and understanding. It doesn't work. Understand the situation in its own terms. Try to get its historical growth and development aright. Then you may in fact find that analogies from some other thing may help you to think more clearly. But they are no answer to anything. They are merely, at best, a pointer to where you had better look. History is a particular thing, and any event that you wish to understand must be studied in its own right, in its own terms, and not by reference to any other, which is what makes it such a difficult instrument for major political understanding. Mm. There's several up there. I'm sorry, what sequence are you going to take them in? Yes. Look, sorry, speak up a little. Again, I can't. This is a bad room for speaking without a mic. Yes. Mm-hmm.
In the morning book, the assessment of blame after Charles II was brought back.
Oh, yes.
Obviously, some people, as John Milton, escaped, and others didn't. And I'm just wondering about the propaganda that went back and forth and the events that led to one person being blamed and another not. And whether it was just boiled down to mere favor with Charles.
Yes, I see. Yeah. The effects of the Restoration, did they have any kind of more principled consequence upon the fates of individuals, or was it just an accident of favor and good fortune, whether you survived or not? In the middle of the second, there were a few obvious victims that had to be put on the scaffold because the king had been killed, people like Sir Harry Vane and so on, and my God, no one deserved it more in some ways. Deadly bore, for one thing. But in the main, yes. If you were in with people who, even though you had not perhaps done the acceptable thing in between, if you were in with people who would be willing to protect you and had the power to do so, yes. On the whole, the interesting thing about 1660 onwards, and it throws light on what happened before, is that the degree of sheer revanchism was very small for events of that order when they happen in the world's history. Nothing like 1815 in France, for instance. Nothing like. There were some victims, not many, very few really. Restoration of property to the deprived, not much of that. Those who got it, kept it. Those who had managed to keep it under disguise in the bad times, kept it now openly. There really was very little major disturbance in 1660, very little. So that the few victims stand out more rather blatantly than they otherwise might have done. On the whole, one gets an impression of a realm and a political nation saying, thank God the aberration time is over, let's have some peace again. A lot of this was owing to General Monk, who was a very sensible man, who was willing to put military power at the service of restoration and had no ambitions as a military dictator himself. So these are accidents of personality, but conditioned by a social scene which really derives its condition from a long, long way back. It was really a country of considerable peace in social relationships. Of course there was trouble, of course people differed, of course there was occasionally somebody got knocked on the head and so on and so forth, and somebody got taken to court. But by the standards of the world's history, 16th and 17th century England was a country of consensus, a term I don't like using because it has overtones of 20th century political science, which it doesn't really, which it shouldn't have. But now, of a common view of the nature of the body politic, so that disturbances in it are ripples on the surface far more than they look to us at this distance. I think that is what happened in 1660. Does that answer the question, Tom?
Yes, thanks.
Right up top there. I think so. I think the answer is what has always been supposed to have been the answer, that is, he couldn't afford to alienate the army. He had to rest on that army for his power. Anti-monarchical sentiment was very strong in the army, and although the Lord Protector's court was a court very much in the monarchical sense, organized and run as a monarch's court, there was just a limit to what the army would accept in this direction. I think Oliver wanted it, if only to demonstrate the continuity. Of course, it would have been a mess anyway, because the next monarch would have been Richard, and who can do much with that, you see? The hereditary principle has its weaknesses, as we all know. But I think that was the real answer to it, yes. He couldn't afford it in the cleft stick he was in.
Mm. If we have time for one more question. Yes.
Humility. humility in the face of the fate of mankind, and arrogance in the face of our colleagues.
Well, I'd like to ask Professor Deloy Guth, who I should say is teaching in the Faculty of Law, but has also been a student of Dr. Elton's, to thank Dr. Elton. Professor Guth.
Thank you very much. You've now all had the benefit of what research students like Tony Knox, who's here tonight, and myself, what we called the Elton Broom. You've had this now as an experience once in your life. Those of us who are research students over several years in Cambridge with Jeffrey had the experience once a fortnight, and it went something like this. We would work like crazy in the public record office in the dirty, dusty parchment manuscripts from the 15th, 16th century material, and then every 2 weeks we'd trot up to Cambridge and we'd report, and he would then sweep our minds free and clear of all of this and send us back. And so I don't want you to think that his sole purpose in life was to create empty minds, but on the contrary, to continue to rub our noses in the parchment, as he used to put it, to keep our nose on the evidence, to try to purge our minds of our prejudices and of all of the intellectual baggage that we'd acquired, in my case, that I'd acquired previously as a student of American history. But now, I'm sure this emphasis and focus on the evidence is one that I hope that we can all take away. And despite your remarks about lawyers and historians, the greatest historian in England, Frederick William Maitland, once said that there is a conflict between the lawyer and the historian, and then it goes something like this, that the historian is always searching for evidence, the older the better. The lawyer is always searching for authority, the newer the better. I think with Professor Elton, I've known him now for 23 wonderful years, and in my mind, he has always combined these two, both a firm grounding in the evidence and a strong authoritative voice. He has incidentally published, he's publishing his most recent book as a biography of Friedrich William Maitland, and in the words of my children, if Maitland is the greatest of English legal historians, then as my children would say, it takes one to know one. Thank you very much, Professor Elton, for coming from London. He's just off the plane, by the way, yesterday, and for coming and giving us a thorough broom job. Thank you again.
Ladies and gentlemen, this meeting is adjourned. Remember next week, Michael W. McCrum, another Cambridge man, Corpus Christi College, Elitism, Egalitarianism, and Excellence.